Translation. What to speak of human beings, even the demigods, demons, siddhas, gandharvas, charanas, and the various directors of the universe, the Prajapatis, have never touched you before. It is not that we are unable to understand your identity. Please repeat after me. What to speak of human beings? Even the demigods, demons, siddhas, gandharvas, charanas, and the various directors of the universe, the Prajapatis, have never touched you before. It is not that we are unable to understand your identity. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Even, excuse me, hang on. Water break. Even the Asuras observe the etiquette that no one should address a married woman with lust. The great analyst Chanakya Pandit said, Mahavat Faradarishu, which means one should consider another one's man's wife to be one's mother. The Asuras, the demons, took it for granted that the beautiful young woman, Mohini Murti, who arrived just before them, were certainly not married. Therefore, they assumed that no one in the world, including the demigods, the Gandharvas, the Charanas, the Siddhas, had ever touched her. The demons knew that the young girl was unmarried, and therefore they dared to address her. They supposed that the young girl, Mohini Murti, had come there to find a husband amongst all those present. But the Daityas were there, the demigods, the Gandharvas, and so on. Om Agyanam Tridam Dasha Janangala Shalakaya Dakshum Minitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Titanya Manobistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Garabayam Tasmati Papadantikam He Krishna Kurnana Sindhu Dina Bandhu Tigatpate Gopisha Gopi Kanta Radha Kantara Mustate Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gurvani Prachadine Nivashesha Shunyavadi Prashachade Shatadine Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sidvaita Garadha Sivasadi Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. What to speak of human beings, even the demigods, demons, siddhas, gandharvas, charanas, and the various directors of the universe, the Prajapatis, have never touched you before. It is not that we are unable to understand your identity. Obviously here we're continuing from the leader of Mohini Murti when she appears just as the nectar of immortality is about to be distributed. But first of all, before I get into Mohini Murti and the demon's relationship with her, as well as the Gandharvas and so on, I just wanted to have a look at some points that I felt sprang out at me in the purport. And one of them, of course, was Prabhupada once again quotes Chanakya Pandit. Now, Prabhupada actually quotes Chanakya Pandit on a number of occasions, and there's, of course, many reasons for that. Not only does Prabhupada often quote Chanakya Pandit, but actually he's quoted by a number of holy people in India. The tradition, the reason that he was from about the 3rd century BC. He was Chanakya Pandit was. He was a great teacher, a royal advisor, and he managed the first Mauryan Empire, and he actually helped at a young age the Mauryan Empire, which is an empire which stretched right from probably present day Indus River right onto Orissa, right across north and central India. And this was after a time when Chanakya Pandit also got rid of any secular influence, like Greek influence, because of the time, of course, it was previous invaders had been the Greeks under Alexander the Great. But Chanakya Pandit was, in many sense, you could say, had restored, the Vedic culture in that perspective. It was an empire that sprang up after Greek occupation. But interestingly enough, he was, of course, a great pandit, great scholar. He was also went to university and everything like that, and so he but also been very spiritual and materially educated. He was able to manage behind the scenes as a minister to the king of this emerging empire in India. So he's very well respected by Prabhupada, quite clearly, as he quotes Chanakya Pandit on a number of occasions. But let's go back now to Mohini Murthy, of course. The first thing we find out, actually, about this particular purport is something quite interesting. It's the demons that react. Remember, what we're dealing with here is a situation where various leaders of the universe split into demigods and demons, i.e. Divine beings and demoniac beings. Basically, at loggerheads with each other and are fighting over this nectar of immortality, which I'll go into more later. But immediately, as soon as Mohini Murthy walks in, we find something happens. It's the demigods that the demons are the ones that actually react. First of all, obviously she's actually Lord Vishnu incarnated in a very, very beautiful, bewilderingly beautiful form. And of course, it's the demons who cannot help themselves. try to chat her up and so forth. But of course, this is interesting. But yet, Prabhupada writes in the purport that even these suras, these demons, although their reputation preceded them as being just that, knew there was some type of etiquette there. First of all, her point of reference was, is this girl married? No. Goody-goody, they probably thought to themselves. But the point is that these demons were leaders of the various demoniac races, and even they had some degree of culture. We even look at, for example, Hiranyakashipu or Ravana and their leaders, and they had some type of culture. It doesn't mean they were divine beings, they were demoniac people, but they had some type of etiquette and culture in order to rule. Otherwise, it's impossible to rule a kingdom, no matter what the nature of that kingdom is, unless you do have some kind of standards. And according to here, as Prabhupada says, that even the demigods did not touch another man's wife. However, the demigods could not understand them, could not control themselves when they assumed and probably hoped that this beautiful young girl, probably the most beautiful, in fact, undoubtedly the most beautiful girl they'd ever seen. We know that because it was an incarnation, of course, of a Vishnu incarnation, who had come to really ultimately make sure that the demons did not get their hands on the nectar of immortality. Because if they do that, then the demons would obviously control the universe, and Vishnu didn't want that, as the demigods were his devotees and not those people. But it's interesting enough, because Mohini Murthy doesn't carry a physical weapon. He doesn't carry a trident like Durga Devi, or doesn't carry a trident like Lord Shiva, or a bow and arrow like Lord Ram, or whatever. Or doesn't even beat people up like Krishna did. Mohini Murthy simply bewilders the demons. How? By her beauty. Why? Because we understand that the difference between in the universe here, on this universal level that we're dealing with, this great divide that we appear to see in the higher echelons of the universe, is that the divine beings in some way were able to control themselves, and the demoniac ones were not able to control themselves. Lust, they could not control their lust. I.e., when they saw Mohini Murthy, they saw her as a potential object for their own sense of gratification, and therefore decided they admit, it says here, as soon as she arrived, they immediately, she's not married, let us approach her, ask her why she's here, is she looking for a husband, I'll be her husband, and so forth. So this tells us a little bit actually about divine aspects of Vedic culture, where the idea of approaching a woman you don't know or members of the opposite sex is seen as being unchaste activity, and is not the activity of Vaishnavas, that there is a certain etiquette when it comes to these type of things. Of course, the demons could not control their lust, and of course, this is quite an interesting scenario, because even, as we know, they've just churned that ocean of milk. They've churned it to produce this nectar of immortality of which they're going to fight about, or have been fighting about. And whoever drinks this cannot die, and ultimately will control the universe. But as this churning was going on, Lakshmi Devi appeared within that churning before the nectar of immortality was created. And apsaras, thousands of apsaras also appeared. Beautiful damsels, not maybe as beautiful as Mohini Murti would appear, but far more beautiful than any woman that we would ever kind of see on this planet Earth, because they were demigods. The apsaras became the wives of the Gandharvas, actually. But the apsaras themselves chose, they were beings in the mode of goodness and so forth, it would appear, so they became attracted to the demigod side. But then the goddess of Varuni, which that means the goddess of alcohol or alcoholic or intoxicating beverage, she came, she also appeared from that ocean of milk. Her hair was a bit disheveled, slightly kind of staggering a little bit. Maybe not quite as beautiful as or as chaste. And where does she go? She goes to the Asuric side. She goes to the demons. So they snap her up. Of course, what is this actually telling us, of course, is the nature of different types of women, but also different types of men that are attracted to different types of women as well. So immediately we begin to see differences here between the demigods and the demons, in the sense that the demigods had no restriction when it came to intoxication, whereas the demigods were not attracted to that side. They were attracted rather to the much more genuine beauty of the apsaras. So let us, as we're talking, of course, about the churning of the ocean of nectar and so forth, the ocean of milk, rather, to produce the nectar, I just wanted to remind ourselves here of the context. It says here that in the introduction to this chapter, it says that when the demigods took possession of the container of nectar, an extraordinarily beautiful young woman appeared before them. All the demons became captivated by the young woman's beauty. Of course, we know that was Mohini Murti. Now, because the demons were fighting amongst themselves to possess the nectar, then they saw Mohini Murti and they selected her as a mediator to settle their quarrel. So they were so, in one sense, they were so bewildered by her absolute beauty, and they were controlled by their lust, their sexual attraction towards her. And they basically, well, okay, we'll listen to what you have to say. Whatever, we trust you. They put so much emphasis on lust, they cannot surpass that. It's understood, actually, that this universe, to surpass this universe, you have to overcome the you cannot let yourself be controlled by attraction to the opposite sex, and so forth. The demons are unable to do that, so they actually said, look, who's going to have the nectar of immortality first? Because whoever has it first is going to get the most. So therefore, obviously there was a finite amount in there. And everyone was afraid they weren't going to get their fair share. So here comes Mohini Murti, and they knew she wasn't going to bother. She was a self-effulgent, and they knew she wasn't going to drink from the nectar of immortality. Well, he said, you decide for us, my dear. So basically, she turned around and said, okay, well, first of all, you got to sit in line, you know, just like people sit in line for prasadam or something like that. So the demigods and demons all sat in rows, of course, and then whatever she gives, they cannot refuse to accept. So the demon said, whatever you say. So Mohini Murti got them all sitting there so she could distribute the nectar at her own discrimination. She knew, of course, that the demons were unfit to receive this nectar. It would be dangerous for the stability of the universe to give them immortality. Therefore, by cheating them, of course, what she did was she decided, okay, I'll just start on this row first. We'll kind of work with the demigods first, and don't worry, demons, we'll come around to serving you. Of course, as time went by, the demons were getting a bit agitated. They didn't want to challenge her. They were too busy looking at her, probably. But slowly but surely, as of course the end line, as the demigods were running out of nectar, the demons realized that they weren't going to get their share. In fact, it was only Rahu that decided to, maybe I should kind of get some here. But let's talk about that in a moment. So basically, Mohini's weapon against the demons was her own beauty, and using the lustful attraction, their weakness. That was their Hercules heel. Because the demons, of course, are very, very powerful, as well as and sometimes in the history of the universe, more powerful than the demigods, at least some of the lower demigods. So it gives you an idea of how powerful they were. However, they do have that Hercules heel, when Mahinamurti was basically able to put them under her thumb like that. It's quite interesting, actually. What we can learn from this is that we understand that most of the demigods and demons present must have all been male. We know that by their reaction to Mahinamurti. So it was obviously a fairly male-dominated universal hierarchy we're dealing with here. Anyway, but let's read a little bit more about Mahinamurti, I thought. There's lots. She's actually involved in other leelas. This is her most famous leela, connected, of course, with the Nectar of Immortality. But there are other leelas that she takes part in as well, and I wanted to share that with you. You could say she's a bit like Vishnu's Maya. There's a similar story of Vikrasura, actually. Everyone knows the story of Vikrasura, who was an incredibly powerful demon in the universe, performed all kinds of austerities, including even offering his own skin into the fire to please Lord Shiva. He tried all kinds of austerities. He was offering his skin into the fire just to kind of get power from Lord Shiva. But Lord Shiva didn't appear, probably because he knew what he would do if he had those powers. Vikrasura, of course, was a great demon. So in the end, Vikrasura was so desperate to get the blessings of Lord Shiva through his austerities, he was even going to slice his own head off. And at that point, Lord Shiva, because of his merciful nature to all people, but also including the Asuras as well, he had to appear. He said, "Okay, Vikrasura, I get your point. What benediction do you require?" Of course, Vikrasura said, "Whatever head I touch will explode into 1,000 pieces. And Lord Shiva said, "Are you sure about that?" And Vikrasura said, "Yeah." Of course, Lord Shiva, being Lord Shiva, couldn't, being the all-merciful one, and also never breaks a promise, he said, "Very well. If that is what you want, then fair dues." So, of course, he gave Vikrasura this incredible power, more just to kill anyone whoever they touched his head, would split into 1,000 pieces. Vikrasura turned around and looked at Parvati, who was with Lord Shiva, and said, "I want her. Will you give it to me?" Lord Shiva said, "Of course you can't. I'm not going to give it to you. What kind of a demon are you?" So then, of course, Vikrasura said, "Well, I'll touch your head, the Lord Shiva, and split you into 1,000 pieces. So Lord Shiva, of course, couldn't. He, by his own mercy and his own benedictions, it turned against him. And Lord Shiva had to go running across the universe, away from the hand of Vikrasura, who was chasing him. Now, there's two different ends to the story. One, of course, is that Vishnu appears in the form of a Brahmin and convinces Vikrasura to basically that Lord Shiva doesn't really have any real powers, and therefore it doesn't matter if he touched your own head because he hasn't really given you any powers anyway. That's one story, of course, where Vikrasura does touch his own head and... Another story, which is interesting, is that Vikrasura ends up marrying or courting Mahinamurti, or a form of Mahinamurti. So there's different leelas. Sometimes leelas repeat themselves or come in different forms. In this leela, Vikrasura actually marries Mahinamurti, or they promise to marry. And of course, Vikrasura, again, just like the demons in the Ocean of Milk leela, he's bewildered by his new consort, his Mahinamurti. He'll do anything she says. Basically, he's again under her thumb. And she says, "Let us dance, let us dance." So he starts dancing with her, and he's copying her, and she's a beautiful dancer, and he's perhaps a bit more clumsy than her at dancing, but he tries to copy her as well. And she does one movement. She goes, "Come on, you have to copy me." So he goes, he touches his own head, and his head explodes into 1,000 pieces. So this is the bewildering nature of the attraction, how men are like butter and women are like fire. And if one isn't pious, then it is very, very difficult to control this lust. Immediately that butter melts and you could become completely bewildered and lose all the power and influence you have. Even all the power in the universe can be gone in an instant, like that. So these are the kind of things that we've been taught. There's another story, of course, with Mahinamurti, where Lord Shiva is quite proud of his asceticism. But let's have a look. It was in the forest. And basically, Mahinamurti appears before Lord Shiva. And there's some versions of the story where, of course, Parvati is also with Lord Shiva at the same time. But when Mahinamurti appears in the forest before Lord Shiva, he breaks from his meditation and he just can't control himself. He thinks, she is so beautiful. And he basically goes running after her. Various things happen. I'll spare you the details. But he does come to his senses eventually after touching her and getting very excited. And eventually he goes back to Parvati, but he remains humbled. And of course, the lesson of this is that even the great Lord Shiva cannot, without Lord Vishnu's mercy, cannot completely be transcendental to everything. Because Lord Vishnu's maya potency is that powerful. So therefore, without the benediction or the mercy of Lord Vishnu, or indeed, of course, Lord Krishna, that illusionary energy cannot be surpassed. So it's quite a kind of an interesting thing. I just wanted to share one or two kind of similar leelas with you on that subject, if I can find my notes, that is. Of course, in the Mahabharata, we find other similar incidences, not necessarily with Mahinamurti, but with Apsaras. The story of in the Ramayana, I think stage, it's mentioned in the Mahabharata as well, sage Vishvamrita. He's doing austerities, great, great austerities in the mountains, in the forests, becoming so powerful that even Lord Indra himself became threatened. Wow, look at what these austerities, even the demigods could see and were admiring the austerities of this great sage. But Lord Indra became threatened because he thought, wow, he's actually going to take my post. He's going to become the next king of heaven. Then I get unemployed. What happens to me? I have to give up my throne to this guy. I know what I'll do. I'll stop him in his austerities. I'll distract him. What shall I do? Oh, I know. I'll send my most beautiful Apsara. And she had a name. Her name was Menaka. So he said, okay, Menaka, you're a beautiful Apsara. Go down and do a dance in front of this sage. Distract him. Let's see what he can do now. So there's Vishvamrita in his meditational pose. And there an Apsara appears before him in a very, very beautiful form. And she starts dancing away and doing this and doing that. And of course, his first instance, he tries hard. But as soon as he opens his eyes, he sees it. And then some wind blows her garments away and she's basically naked. And at that point, Vishvamrita just cannot control himself. And he has to basically go and have sex with her. Of course, during that time, his austerities were put on hold, and Lord Indra was able to remain keeping his post. So his little trick worked there. Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai, Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai. There are other similar stories, but if we look at Chaitanya Lila, we find a different aspect. We find throughout the history, as mentioned, a history of this Kalpa in this universe. In this mention of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find many fall downs of great sages by the bewildering form of a woman. We find that it's a constant theme, actually. It's mentioned many times. But if we look at Chaitanya Lila, as I mentioned, we find something slightly different, which in many ways gives an idea of the strength and the potency of the holy name. And of course, that's the leader of Haridas Thakur, who was chanting all the time. He was in a cave at the time, and all he was doing was chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So Haridas was chanting and chanting and chanting. How many rounds a day was he chanting, Maharaj? Do you remember, Haridas took? 300 rounds a day. 192 rounds a day. So that's a lot of rounds. I can barely manage my 16 as... And even then, that's lucky. But imagine, so he must have been chanting all day, practically speaking. So what happens? Someone sends a beautiful prostitute to distract him, to test him, to try and bring his reputation down. So Haridas Thakur is there. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, etc. Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna. So this is going on. And then in the cave, suddenly this very beautiful girl, I don't think she was quite in the league of Mahinamurti or any of the Apsaras, because they were demigods or Vishnu incarnations. However, by earthly standards, a beautiful prostitute appears before Haridas Thakur and goes into various kind of attractive and evocative kind of poses and so forth. And she said, will you sleep with me, Harry Dass? Come on, you're such a great sage. He goes, well, let me just finish my rounds first, and then we'll spend some time together. She says, okay, just wait outside the cave, or just wait over there, just let me finish it'll just take me an hour or so, just let me chant. She says, okay. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram. Of course, what happens is he never stops chanting. She says, are you ready yet? No. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And this goes on, and then she gets the hint. And eventually, of course, she realizes that he's not going to stop chanting, and I'm not going to be able to seduce this holy person. He's just simply too holy. So what does she do? She climbs down from the mountains, and she gives up. So this gives an idea of how in the literatures, the Vedic literature, the Puranic literature, and the Chaitanya-charitamrita, how examples of those that cannot control themselves and those that are able to control themselves. And it's only by sadhana, ultimately, and prayer and sadhana, that we can hope to control ourselves, we men. So let's look, of course, where do human beings fit into this? We see, when we look into the churning of the ocean of milk, we see the demigods are by one nature, the demons are of another, and ultimately they are who they are. They've taken birth in those forms for that very reason. Human beings on this planet, we're a bit different, because we are ultimately in the middle. The Earth is described as a middle planet. It is not a hellish planet. It is not an atheistic planet, and it is certainly not a heavenly planet either. We have a mixture on this Earth planet of enough enjoyment not to be a hellish planet, but nowhere near enough enjoyment to be a heavenly planet. So therefore we're in the middle. This Earth almost acts like perhaps a chessboard, a middle place, which is enacted by, of course, the Cold War, or sometimes the actual war that goes on between the demigods and the demons, where we ultimately, as individuals, especially in the Kali Yuga, we choose ourselves. The demigod and the demon as in nature is within our own selves. In former yugas, of course, demoniac and demoniac natures were in different universes or in different parts of the universe, in different planets, in different countries. But in the Kali Yuga, both potential for both extremes are actually within our own selves. And this is played out on a macrocosmic level in the universe, as we can see. So we're not alone. In the Leela of the churning of the ocean of milk, it's described there were 91 asuras present and 88 devas were representing. So it wasn't the entire population of the universe that were involved in this churning of the ocean of milk. It was obviously representatives or leaders in some ways. But the actuality that this universe, going back to Prabhupada's purport here, actually, where he's describing about the Siddhas, the Gandharvas, who were, of course, on the side of the demigods, who didn't move on Mahinimurti in the way that the demons did. But it describes the Prajapatis. There's a lot of mention here of all these different races going on. And we know there's 400,000 different human or humanoid species across the universe. But these actually include, this is not just talking about earthly humans, because 400,000 different species would not possibly be just on the earth. We don't have that many. We have a handful of species, human species on the earth. But across the universe, 400,000 different species, and these include the upper devas or the demons as well. So they're, in one sense, they're like us. They are human-like in appearance, but of course they're, the power they have and the potency they have is a lot different from ours. Amongst all the different human-like species across the universe, human beings, in materially, we are the least powerful, actually. Others have much more power than we do. But you understand, just like we have the UN or the United Nations or something like that, in the universe, they have their own version. They have their own galactic federation where they sometimes get together to do yagyas for Lord Vishnu. They have their own... it seems that the different races, Gandharvas and Siddhas, for example, sometimes collaborate together. But there is obviously, at some point, because they have obtained these bodies through karma often, at some point there's a division that takes place between the pious and the impious. So there isn't the kind of unity across the universe between these, the divine and demoniac beings. There's only unity amongst all the demigods and unity amongst all the asuras, who are ultimately have been warring between themselves since time immemorial. And we read about this. We learn that there was great wars that went on between the demons and the various demon races and the various demigod races of various levels. For example, Upper Devas means a minor demigod, like a Gandharva or something like that. We even learn, actually, in the last Kali Yuga, Buddha, of course, doesn't just come as in our recent Buddha that we all think of, Gautama Siddhanta. Buddha has become many, many times, many incarnations, they come again and again. So in the last Kali Yuga, for example, Buddha took birth to bring peace, or to bring a truce between the demigods and the demons, who are at war with each other in their celestial airplanes and their spaceships and so forth. They were actually having a galactic battle going on, and actually their engines could be heard from the earth as Lord Buddha was preaching. So this is quite an interesting thing that's going on. So this ongoing theme, this ongoing war, or even a cold war actually, between the different mentalities of the universe. Those who are devotees of Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna, and those who are ultimately atheists and only believe in themselves. However, they're both powerful in different ways. I wanted to share with you, in the last few minutes, I wanted to share with you a little bit about that, actually, about the different races that are mentioned in the Bhagavatam that exist. Of course, on the Devas side, we'll start with the good guys. We have the higher Devasas. You know, you've got Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, Kartikeya, in many ways, Hanuman, of course, he's Shiva Tattva, the sun god and the moon god. These are higher Devas. But there's others, there's like the rishis, of course, great, powerful, holy people. Gandharvas, who are husbands of the many different types and breeds of Apsaras. They have great musical skills. They have wonderful singing voices. They guarded the summer and made beautiful music for the gods in the palaces. So they will be ultimately like almost like in a servant mode, where they'll be playing music to for the entertainment of Lord Indra, for example. So they would be like travelling musicians who also act as messengers between gods and human beings, which is also almost like angels, actually. There seems to be quite a similarity with Abrahamic faith, where the Gandharvas appear to be some type of angelic beings who were playing with harps and so forth. Quite interesting. But others mentioned in this verse were the Chalanas. And I was trying to find out a little bit about their nature. I thought, I know what Gandharvas are like. What about the Chalanas? So from what I understand, they were much more intellectual. Loyalty to the demigod order were an intellectual race. We're perhaps looking after much more of recording and so on and so forth like that. The Siddhas, of course, also mentioned in the purport in the verse here, are perfected beings whose bodies are completely subtle bodies and are full of paranormal abilities. But often the Siddhas are those who are great sages who have been awarded a Siddha-like body. Those who've got incredible powers that they've got from their good karma, if you like, from perhaps being a holy man or a sage or an ascetic on the earth in a previous life. The Kinnanas, celestial musicians, just like the Gandharvas, but different from the Gandharvas because they're sometimes half bird or half horse. So the Kinnanas basically are just, you find this in Greek mythology as well, quite interestingly enough, or similarities in North legends as well, where you know, the body of a horse and the torso and the head of a human being. Again, in the Vedic culture, these things actually exist, but on a subtle level. Prajapatis, presiding over the procreation of the universe, protectors of life. Prajapatis were elected democratically. Then you got the Vidyadharas, possessing mystical magic powers and dwell in the Himalayas. And they also, probably they dwell subtly in Mount Kailash. And they are servants of Lord Shiva. and have they can shrink or and they can grow their size, endowed like that, and they live with the Kanaras apparently. The Manus, of course, these are all the demigods. The Manus are the progenitors of mankind. Vaishvata Manu, Svayambhava Manu, Ishvaku Manu. These are all, to get the title Manu, it appears you have to be, ultimately a progenitor or an ultimate father of mankind. And again, there are different Manus, and their job is to basically place human beings, obviously like us, across the universe in different ways. So it's described in the beginning of this Satyayuga. Ishvaku Manu was the father of mankind, and that's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. Supanas were celestial birds, perhaps like the same race as Garuda. Celestial birds that could fly from one planet to another. Vasus, attendants of Indra, and later Vishnu, gods of nature. Adityas, the Adityas have been described in the Rig Veda as bright and pure, as streams of water, free from falsehood, blameless and perfect, and were the offspring of Aditya. And so what I'll do is I'll finish off the class in a few moments, but I wanted to also share with you some of the demoniac races as well that existed. The Rakshasas, we know about the Rakshasas, of course, as Ravana was a Rakshasa. Shape-shifting, man-eating, powerful beings, very dangerous, of course, particularly when they were around during the time of Lord Ram. Yakshas were ghost-like beings. Nagas, of course, Nagas are described in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam as being snake-like, humanoid, snake-like reptilian beings who would live in subterranean caverns underneath the earth, underneath the subterranean realms. Some of the leaders would have jewels on their heads, and they would use that light from that jewel to see in the darkness. They're described as being heartless and cruel beings. So if you bump into any of those, I wouldn't hang around. The Daityas were children of Aditi and the sage Kashyapa, and a race of demoniac giant beings, and Hiranyakashipu, of course, being one of them. But they had many other children as well, it would appear. And then, of course, there's the Rudras. The Rudras, of course, were ultimately forms or incarnations of Lord Shiva, who were very much destructive and fiery gods, who would, of course, be involved in the destruction, and particularly destruction of planets, particularly, in the end, of course, the universe itself. And there's Maruts as well, who are ultimately, they say, responsible for causing storms in the universe like that. So quite a few things. So all these different beings having effects directly or indirectly on humankind itself exist throughout the universe. And this is, again, an ongoing theme in the Bhagavatam, actually. What time does class normally go to? 8:30. All right, so it's 8:30 now. There's one or two other things I could mention. I just wanted to complete the introduction to this chapter, as I only read the first half. It kind of completes the leader off, really. It says, when the demons saw this cheating of Mihini Murti, because, of course, the demons, of course, realized that Mihini Murti wasn't given them their expected share of the nectar, they remained silent because they were so bewildered by her beauty. But one demon named Rahu dressed himself like a demigod and sat down in the line of the demigods. He sat beside the sun and the moon. So when Mihini Murti saw that Rahu was cheating, she immediately cut off the demon's head. Sudarshan Chakra. Of course, Rahu's head gets removed. That becomes, of course, the astronomical planet of Rahu, which has, in astronomy and astrological charts, has a negative effect on one's life. But of course, he drank the nectar. He drank some of it before Mihini had time to kill him. But it came up to his neck. So the nectar didn't go to his stomach, it only went down to his throat. Therefore, his head became the Rahu planet, because that bit became immortal. Correct. Thanks for mentioning that. I should have mentioned that. Interestingly enough, of course, in astrology, Rahu being a negative influence or a negative planet in our astrological charts, it is understood that Rahu isn't altogether bad, because the effects of Rahu can be counteracted by spiritual practice and sadhana. which is interesting. It's significant. In other words, we need Vishnu's chakra at that point to help us overcome the effects of Rahu. So those who are into astrology, if everyone is going through a Rahu period in life, although that is bad materially, one can actually become very successful spiritually in that. So it's actually like a benediction of Rahu. We need Mahinamurti's mercy, actually, in that sense. And that way we can only... but of course, during a Rahu period in our life or whatever, if you believe in astrology, you should never always be careful not to get yourself be bewildered by lust. So I'll stop there. If anyone's got any corrections or comments, then this is your time.